Good morning, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to MomsFightingAutism.com. This session is being pre-recorded. It is for our autism conference, which will be broadcast April 9th and 10th, and we're so pleased that you're joining us. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis, and I will be with you for the hour and a half webinar this morning, which will be rebroadcast again, like I said, April 9th or 10th. There's a schedule on the MomsFightingAutism.com website, so you can go there and see the itinerary. There are two ways to participate today. If you're joining us for the pre-recording session, you can log in to MomsFightingAutism.com, and about halfway down the page, you'll see the conference sign-up sheet, and you will click that, and then you will register, and you'll get an email that will tell you how to log into the webinar. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806, and you will enter conference ID number 168978-POUND. That's 168978-POUND. We have a pretty long slideshow today. We're going to try to get through it so we can listen to your questions live. I will let you know how to raise your hand to ask me a question later. You can also submit your questions through the website. So when you log in, you'll see a blue box up in the left-hand corner. And there is a welcome, listen in, slides, ask a question. Those are all active. So when the slideshow begins, you'll just click slides, and you'll be able to view the slides as they go along. Also, it's important to note at the bottom of the slideshow, there's two buttons. One says to synchronize the slides with the phone. The other one says synchronize slides with the webcast. So if you're listening in by phone, you're going to want to click that button, and it will synchronize the audio with the slides, so there's no overlap. Okay, so without further ado, I will introduce our speaker tonight. I'm used to doing it at night. Today we have Dr. Jed Baker, who's going to be talking about All Children Can Succeed, Effective Interventions for Behavioral and Social Challenges. Dr. Baker is the director of Social Skills Training Project, a private organization serving individuals with autism and social communication problems. He also directs social skills trainings for the Milburn Public Schools in New Jersey. He's on the Professional Advisory Board of Autism Today, ASPEN, A-S-P-E-N, ANSWER, YAI, the Kelberman Center, and several other autism organizations. In addition, he writes, lectures, and provides training internationally on the topics of social skills training and managing challenging behaviors. He is an award-winning author of 5 books, which he will talk about in detail, and his work has also been featured on ABC World News, Nightline, the CBS Early Show, and the Discovery Health Channel. He also just enlightened me as to a new Apple or Droid app, and he will be telling us more about that too. Welcome, Dr. Baker.
Oh, thank you very much. So I want to talk to you all today about effective interventions for behavioral social challenges, so challenging behavior and teaching social skills. And from my point of view, you know, 90% of that work depends on not just the strategies we'll talk about, but how you feel about implementing those strategies, how you feel at the moment with that student who may be really challenging you. So by example, you know, a common issue I go and consult for schools, you have a youngster, perhaps the teacher has said or a parent has said, you know, I want you to do this worksheet. And they throw a chair across the room. They say, I hate you. I can't stand you. And so what happens in that setting? Well, we have a variety of feelings about that if we're the parent, we're the teacher. And what typically happens in a school setting is there's a discipline code. You can't throw a chair across the room. So the kid gets sent to the principal's office. The principal says to the kid, you know, you can't throw a chair across the room. You can't yell at your teacher like that. And so then the kid curses at the principal. The principal, you know, F you to the principal. And the principal says, you know what, kiddo, you lost recess now. You know, you can't go to recess. And so the kid's more angry now, and he says it again, F you to the principal. And now the principal says, you've lost recess for the whole week now. And they call the parents, let them know about this behavior. The parents are embarrassed about it, and they say to the kid, well, you know what, you're grounded for the week. You can't go outside. You can't play any electronics, et cetera. Well, the bus comes to take the kid to the school the next day, and they can't get the kid on the bus. He refuses to go. And this is a typical example of sometimes what happens when we enter these escalating power struggles. That, you know, it's okay to have a discipline code. It's a good thing to have rules and consequences. So many schools, and at home, we need to have that kind of structure. It's just if that doesn't work, and we keep going down the discipline road over and over and over again, sometimes we end up in this escalating power struggle. On the other hand, if we see the fear behind this kid's behavior, that when we give him a math worksheet to do, that perhaps he's intimidated, he doesn't know how to handle it, and he acts out. We call that fear leading to anger, that some of us, when we're threatened, we get angry. And so if we see the fear behind this behavior, maybe we go down a road of how do we help this kid feel less threatened so he doesn't have to act out this way. So this is what I want to talk to you today about, that it's okay to have rules and consequences and discipline, but when it doesn't work, we need to understand better what's going on for this kid. How do we help that individual feel less threatened so they don't have to act out that way? But all of it begins with how we feel, because at that moment when a kid throws a chair at you and yells at you, you know, do we lose our temper and get angry and engage in a power struggle with that kid? Or are we intimidated ourselves and we just give in? Go ahead. All right, fine. You don't have to do the work today. That's fine. You threw the chair. You know, this is what we're often confronted with at this moment of truth. When we are threatened, when we are intimidated, we sometimes either give in, we concede to the child, or we get angry because they pressed our buttons. They're not respecting us. So all of it starts with how we feel. I'm going to advance the first slide. We know that getting angry can make things worse over time because research is very clear that if we lose our temper and we are aggressive with our kids, we have kids and or young adults who are aggressive with us. They learn everything from what we do. On the other hand, if we just give in all the time, that's not a good long-term solution either, because then they've learned they can just wear us down. So giving in and losing our temper make it worse. What are we left with? 90% of teaching and parenting, from my point of view, is tolerance. You know, can we tolerate our discomfort in that moment when we're feeling challenged by our own children or students or clients we work with? Can we tolerate it long enough not to give in, not to lose our temper, but to think carefully how we move this kid forward? You know, and discipline is a starting point. Have rules and consequences, but when it doesn't work, we need to dig deeper and understand why it's happening so we can prevent the problem and not just react to it. So let's talk first about how we deal with our own feelings. How do we handle our own feelings? The first issue is hope. We have to have hope that things can get better. Very interesting research by my previous supervisor when I was a graduate student many years ago, Mark Durand. He's written a book called Optimistic Parenting. And in that book, he talks about research on hope, parental optimism. And it turns out, you know, if you have a 3-year-old who's very aggressive behavior, you want to see what predicts how challenging their behavior will be as a 6-year-old. It's not how aggressive or challenged they were in terms of their language at 3 years old that is the best predictor of how they'll be at 6 years old. It turns out parental optimism, hope, was a better predictor of how they would behave. That when parents had hope, they found ways to bring peace to that house. But if you lose hope, then you start saying things like, I can't change my kid's behavior, or my kid can't change. You know, that's just the way he is. That's just the way she is. So we begin to concede to them. Or we lose our temper because we're so angry about that situation that it can't be changed. We're so upset about it that we lose our temper. But when you have hope that things can change, you do the things eventually to help your kid get to a better place. Except you have to expect delays in when that's going to happen. You know, it's spring coming up. a lot of allergies in lots of parts of the country. And what your kid could do a month ago, all of a sudden they can't do. We have to have hope that things will get better, but it may not be in our time frame. We have to respect that kids are going to sometimes do it as they're ready to do it in terms of what's going on with them at that moment. Second issue is that the individual's behavior is not intended just to challenge your authority, right? That's important to understand when we're dealing with our own feelings. That if a kid looks at you and he says, "You're not my boss. I don't care what you say." They're defiant, non-compliant, oppositional, not going to listen to you. If we see that as a kid who doesn't respect our authority, they don't get that we're in charge, then we're going to get angry. We start to take it personally. This kid does not value my position as the boss, as the parent, as the teacher. But if instead we see it as a kid who just lacks coping skills, doesn't know any better, because if he had better coping skills, wouldn't he figure out something better to say than "You're not my boss, you can't control me"? Because that doesn't work very well. That doesn't help him get a job or get on well in school. When I see, as a parent or a teacher, when I see behavior like that as a sign that the kid doesn't have coping skills, I'm a much happier person. Because then I realize my job is to help this kid over time figure out a better way to deal with themselves. And I realize it has nothing to do with me when they say that. It's not about whether they respect or disrespect me. It's about their skill level. Okay. Some of our kids have these skills. We call them congenital attorneys. They come out of the womb negotiating and charming everybody. But other kids don't have those skills. They don't know how to get what they want. They just kick, they bite, they run away, they shut down. And we need to give them, teach them over time, better ways to get what they need. And the last issue, you know, sometimes we're worried about what everybody else thinks. People are watching us in a diner. Those folks somewhere in the diner, they're judging us. "Oh, that family shouldn't bring their kids to a diner. They have no control over their kids." And there are those judgmental people out there, but there are not that many of them. And we can't worry about what they think. People respect us for our ability to control ourselves, not for our ability to 100% control our kids, our clients, or our students. It's not possible 100% to control another human being, but we're respected for being in control of ourselves. And so I don't worry about what other people think as long as I've got myself under control and know that it may take some time to help my child or my client or my student get themselves under control. If you can do these three things, handle your own feelings, the rest is going to be easy. The first step is to handle our own feelings, be in control so that we can think thoughtfully about what to do and not just lose our temper and not just give in. What I want to talk to you about is where some of these challenging behaviors come from. And then mostly what I'm going to talk to you about today are three things around dealing with challenging behaviors. Number one, the relationship you have with your child or your student or your client. Do they trust you? Hard to do anything else without that. Second thing is some crisis management tools. What do we do in the moment of a meltdown or really challenging out-of-control behavior? How do we de-escalate and soothe that individual to put out the fire? And then the third thing I want to talk to you about is how do we prevent the problem? That if you have a repeat problem, we can't just keep putting fires out all the time. Can't just respond to it as a crisis. We have to get to a point where we can prevent the problem. And to do that, we have to understand what triggers the problem. So I'm going to lay out for you 7 very common categories of triggers. If you know what triggers your youngster, your client, your student, then we're in a better position to prevent the behavior. You know, so if a kid doesn't want to do their homework, maybe they don't want to write. They have writing issues, so we learn to modify the writing. They don't have to do all the writing. We've set up an outline for them. We've taught them a skill that they can ask for help instead of refusing to write or throwing chairs across the room. Those are called replacement skills. We'll talk about ways to set up prevention plans. But I also want to talk to you about teaching skills. I'm going to do that right now. Not only teaching skills to replace challenging behaviors, other ways to deal when you're upset, but also just ways to learn how to make friends and get along with people. And there's plenty of research that there are these one-size-fits-all curriculums that can help schools, like anti-bullying programs or problem-solving curriculums. And when you put kids in school through those programs, you see benefit to the school, less bullying, better problem solving among their students. So there are skills for all. Everybody can learn that can help school systems. But there's other research to show that if you're trying to teach kids who have special needs and specific skill deficits, those one-size-fits-all curriculums aren't working very well to help those kids with the skill issues they have. Scott Bellini and Gresham, before Scott Bellini, did some outcome studies looking at how we're teaching social skills to kids in schools. Bellini's work was looking at outcome studies with kids on the autism spectrum. And his review of all these outcome studies suggested social skills training just wasn't working very well for those kids. That for one thing, they weren't generalizing skills. Some kids who were verbal could tell you what they learned, don't call out, don't grab the ball at recess, but they didn't do it. They didn't generalize it. Second issue was that we weren't always teaching relevant skills. That sometimes these one-size-fits-all curriculums wouldn't hit the mark for a kid with special needs. So you got a kid, you put them through a one-size-fits-all curriculum, maybe you're teaching kids how to greet each other, say hello, and ask to join in, can I play? So I go and consult for a kid, and he's in one of these curriculums, you know, and he's on the spectrum, and he's learning how to say hi, can I play, and all these skills. And it turns out he doesn't need those skills. His issue is he doesn't edit himself, that every day he says things that offend people. He said to a bunch of girls, your clothes are a crime against fashion. You know, and to a third grader, how come you can't read? Is something wrong with you? I don't understand. And he would just insult people. Well, learning to say, hi, can I play? Hi, how are you? And can I play? Wasn't helping him. He needed to learn specifically what topics he can think but not say out loud, what we call our sensitive topics. So when we're teaching kids with special needs, there's certain key components of skills training we need to keep in mind, and I'm going to go over those with you right now. Okay? First is making sure we're teaching relevant skills. If we want skills to generalize, we're going to ask parents, teachers, and all those surrounding that student to coach that youngster to use particular skills. Well, we can't give you a list of 50 to 70 skills to work on. We're going to prioritize three or four themes that are critical. And to come up with those skills that are critical, we're going to ask parents and teachers two very practical questions. Given where you want that student to function successfully, what do they do too much of or too little of in order to function successfully? So say you have a 15-year-old who wants to work at Dunkin' Donuts over the summer. We ask, well, what is he doing too much of or too little of in order to function successfully at Dunkin' Donuts? And we find that one of the things he does too much of is he has his finger up his nose while he's working at Dunkin' Donuts. We realize an important skill then is to get the finger out of the nose, right? And there's no theory that tells us we need to do that. That's a very practical approach to teaching skills. What is it going to take to be successful at that job? Too much behavior is often disruptive behavior. Too little is often missing skills, like maybe the youngster doesn't assert himself, doesn't initiate conversation or play with others. So we'll send some of our social skill menus and letters out to parents and teachers asking them those questions. Help us articulate three or four, two to three. There's no magic number, but it has to be a doable amount of number. Priority skills, what do they do too much of, too little of in order to function? We did that for one kid who had no interest in playing with other kids at recess. So we wanted him to learn how to play with other kids. And so we prioritized that skill, joining in with others at recess. So we taught him how to play tag, and we sent him out to play tag at recess. And he said, no, thank you, leave me alone. And that gives us the second issue, second key component of skills training, motivation. Even though we can articulate what's relevant to teach, like for this kid it was joining in play, if a kid isn't motivated to learn that skill or demonstrate that skill, it won't matter. So we have to think about how to motivate kids. So sometimes we reward them with external rewards. We say, if you play tag with the other kids, if you join in, we're going to give you a special reward. You can have your corn chips. You can have access to your dinosaur video that you like to watch. So we come up with an external reward. Sometimes that works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we need to think about intrinsic motivation. Another way to motivate. So we say to the kid, well, what do you like at recess? He doesn't like playing tag, but he loves animals. So we start playing the animal guessing game with him at recess because he's obsessed with animals and he knows a lot about them. So we change Recessed for him to be a little bit about playing the animal guessing game, where he has to, you know, guess what people are acting out. Now he likes playing at Recess. That's more intrinsic motivation because it's built into Recess. It's not an external reward. And so we said, well, let's play the animal guessing game. So now we got him motivated, and he goes out to Recess. He grabs people by the hair and says, let's play the animal guessing game. Well, that leads us to the next key component of skills training, skill acquisition. Just because he wants to play the animal guessing game doesn't mean he knows how. You can't grab people's hair. So skill acquisition refers to making sure we very clearly explain, lay out, you know, step by step, how to join in at Recess. Now, to do that, we have to figure out how best to teach them. If you're a verbal kid, we can explain what to do to you, and then we can show you what to do and coach you to do it. We call that explaining, modeling, and role-playing, structured learning. If you don't have much language, we can't sit and explain it to you. You know, you can't say to the kid who has very little language, if you go up and grab someone by the hair, you're freaking them out, they won't play with you. So we tend not to go on in an abstract verbal way explaining to youngsters who have very little language. Instead, we'll show you what to do and coach you to do it. Some of our ABA strategies are just that. I'll show you what to do, coach you to do it, and provide some incentive. Maybe I can show you through video or pictures as well to make it concrete. So we're going to select a strategy based on their language functioning. The kid has a lot of language, we can explain it, model it, and role play it. Very little language, we can model it and role play it and coach them to do it, right? We also have to consider generalization, because we can pull that kid out, teach them how to join in, and then an hour later, it's time for Recess, we send them out, and what do? They go and grab someone's hair again, because they don't generalize skills. The research is very clear that teaching a skill doesn't guarantee that they'll generalize it, that is, use the skill when they need it. So the next key component of skill training is to make sure that we're going to set up a situation where that kid can be coached to use that skill in a real setting. And to generalize skills, there are three things we usually do. Prime, coach, and review. Prime the kid ahead of time, coach him in the moment, review afterwards. If we want this kid to join in successfully at Recess, we're going to have to prime him before Recess, coach him in the moment, and maybe review afterwards. So we have to find someone to go out to Recess with him. The reality is many schools won't have somebody to send out to Recess with your kids. But we might find that once a week in the beginning of the year we can get somebody to go out. Maybe not 5 days a week, but if we want to make a change in Recess, we're going to have somebody out there with him at least some of the time coaching him in that real deal situation. The other key component is what we call peer sensitivity. So many of our kids are rejected and isolated, and we can't just spend all our time trying to get our kids to fit in. We have to get everyone else to be more engaging and understanding, to do things like reach out to our kids who are isolated, or better yet, stand up for them if they're teased or bullied. So at least half of what I do and what some of our ABC News and Nightline segments were about were creating these peer buddy programs to make sure that our kids were not isolated, and that at times they had something almost like a bodyguard, someone who would stand up for them and say, hey, leave him alone, he's a friend of mine, or anonymously go get help. If you want to make a dent in bullying, the most important thing you can do in a school is create a good bystander program where peers stand up for each other, because a lot of bullying happens when teachers and parents don't see it. So we want peers to stand up for each other or at least go get help and report it, okay? So the last key component of skills training is what we call evaluating outcome, making sure this works. So we're going to have to get some observational measures, perhaps some subjective ratings from parents and teachers to measure whether any of our skill efforts are working. So if you ask me, what is the Baker model of social skills training? It's just those components. It's basically making sure we have figured out what is relevant to teach, number one. Number two, making sure kids are motivated, students are motivated, either intrinsically or extrinsically, that we've taught those skills explicitly, what we call skill acquisition. Doesn't mean we have to always have a group. Sometimes we do it individually, sometimes we do it in a group, sometimes we do it in the class for everybody. last, and then we need to make sure we generalize skills. We can't just teach a skill in isolation. We have to coach kids in their natural settings. And then we have to work on everybody else to be more engaging. Those are the key components. Let's move on now. Let's talk a little bit about where these challenging behaviors come from. A lot of our kids have difficulty with abstract thinking. It means imagining what doesn't really exist, what you have to do in your head, what you can't see right in front of you. Taking someone else's point of view is abstract. I can't see what you're thinking, unless you see one of my social skill books, where we, our picture books, where we put bubbles over people's heads to show what people are thinking. If I can't imagine what people are thinking, I'm going to sometimes make some mistakes socially because I don't realize what I should do and not do. That kid who says, your clothes are a crime against fashion, you know, that misbehavior is unintentional. He doesn't get what other people are thinking. He doesn't have that perspective taking. So one of the things we need to think about is that some of this misbehavior we see from our kids is based on their lack of abstract thinking, lack of perspective taking. They don't know the impact they're having on others. So we need to explain more than we discipline. We need to tell that kid, it's not okay to say that to that girl, your clothes are a crime against fashion. It hurts her feelings. You might not care. So we say, well, other people heard you say that too, people who you like playing with, and they're going to think you're judgmental. And then we can eventually get him to realize, oh, he's got to edit himself. Right? Inflexibility is another issue. If you have difficulty with abstract thinking, you're not going to be a great problem solver. You may just learn one way to do things. You know, every day we write in our journal in school, we write something like who, what, when, where about some article we read. And today the teacher says, well, I want you to give your opinion about the article. And that kid can't do it. He's, oh, that's not what we do. We just write who, what, when, where. Because everything needs to be the same. He can't imagine. He can't problem solve a different way to do things. Because that takes energy. It doesn't take energy if everything goes exactly as we expect it. But as soon as you start to change things, to veer away from their rigid schedule, well, then you have to do some thinking, and that takes a lot of energy. And our kids are expending already all their energy just trying to sit still in school and listen and deal with the fact that someone might tease them or that they might have to read out loud and a teacher might, you know, ask them in front of the class to read out loud and kids might laugh or that they may have sensory issues. It takes all their energy. And so sometimes to change things up is more than they can take. And so for me, behavior management is not so much about how to react to behavior with rewards or consequences. It's how to prevent challenges by getting kids ready for what's unexpected. You know, they expected that they were going to have music. They expected that they were going to get a toy when you went to the toy store. And all of a sudden they're not getting what they want. A meltdown ensues. So a lot of behavior management is about getting them ready for what's not in their expectation. Third issue is what we call low frustration tolerance. Some of our kids get upset very easily. And you don't have to have a disorder to get upset easily. Any of us can get upset easily when we're sleep deprived. Research on sleep deprivation shows that when typical folks are sleep deprived, if you put their brains on a functional MRI, you find that their limbic system, that's the emotional part of the brain that controls their fight, flight, or freeze response system, that survival mode functioning, that's very much still functioning when people are sleep deprived. But the forebrain, that's the reasoning part of the brain, that's not working very well. We're not thinking, we're not reasoning as well as we used to. And there's no logic left. So when we're really sleep deprived, we're walking around like crocodiles. They call that limbic system the crocodile part of the brain. It's a very rudimentary survival mode form of functioning. So many of our kids, you know, when that limbic system is threatened enough, it can hijack the rest of the brain, according to Daniel Goleman in his book Emotional Intelligence, that if you threaten that limbic system enough, the brain can say, you know, shut down forebrain. There's no time to think here. We just have to survive. And this is the way it is for lots of our kids entering a school or a community. They're threatened on a daily basis. They may have sensory issues, so it's overwhelming from a sensory point of view. They may have learning problems, so they're feeling very anxious that they're going to be embarrassed or put in a position where they can't perform. They may have social issues, their fear of being rejected or teased or bullied. All of those lead to that limbic system getting charged, and at some point it may hijack the rest of the brain. Brain says, no time to think. We just have to survive. That's what it means to have a meltdown, that we're in that limbic system, that fight. They're going to fight, yell, scream, or they're going to flee, run away, or just shut down. That's limbic system functioning. And you can't talk with a kid in that moment so easily when they're really in that meltdown mode, because that's like talking to a crocodile, different part of the brain. So what we need to do is figure out how to soothe and calm that part of the brain. The issue here is when you are in, if you have trouble with that limbic system, controlling your emotions, and at the same time you have trouble problem solving, that spells multiple meltdowns. I get revved. My limbic system is a little dysregulated. The logic brain isn't there anymore, and I don't know how to solve the problem. So that spells multiple meltdowns. Those kids who get diagnosed with bipolar disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, ADD, a lot of doctors are then giving them an official label to say they're having trouble controlling that limbic system. Okay? So what do we do when someone's in that crocodile mode? First issue in terms of behavior management is I got to build trust. If my kid, my student, my client is a crocodile in a moment, and it's my job to help calm them down and work with them, I hope they trust me. Because what do crocodiles do if they don't trust you? If they can run away, they'll run. If they can't, they're going to bite your head off. So I got to make sure they trust me. How do we establish trust? Well, number one, we need to show warmth and caring. A guy named Willingham wrote a book, Why Kids Don't Like School, and he reviewed survey after survey of what makes a good teacher. First dimension of what makes a good teacher is warmth and caring. It does matter that that kid, at the end of the day, likes his teacher, likes his parents, and realizes they're on his side. At the moment, we might push our kid further or our client further than they can go. They're just like us, but at the end of the day, they know that we're in their corner. Warmth and caring is important. Second issue is we need to be organized. Structure, right? We need to be able to, in a classroom or at home, providing structure, visual supports, differentiated instruction, all of that reduces frustration. What does all that mean? Well, you know, you're in a classroom, you may have lots of different levels. And if we differentiate that instruction so we're not overly frustrating a particular child, we reduce frustration for that class. If we provide enough visual supports, people know better what's going on at home or in school. So all of that leads to less frustration, more trust. We need to build confidence with what we call the 80-20 rule. That means, in terms of building a relationship, that we become associated with the kid feeling confident about themselves. We give them 80% of what they can do easily before we give them the 20% that's difficult. If all we ever do is give them work that's too difficult for them and they mess up with that, then we become associated with frustration. Okay? So what does it mean? Kid has homework to do. Maybe it's difficult for them. We're the ones who are pushing to get them to do the homework. Then we become associated with frustration. But if we simplify that work at first for a kid who's chronically frustrated, build that relationship so that they can be successful with us and build confidence, 80% of what they can do, then the 20% that's difficult, that's the better way to build a positive relationship at first. Avoid escalating power struggles. What does that mean? It means, like in my opening story, don't go tit for tat punishing a kid for every misbehavior. So the kid misbehaves, you punish them, they misbehave again, you punish them again, they misbehave again, you punish them again, and you're in an escalating power struggle. You can have rules and hold firm to them. We can say you got to do your homework before watching TV, and we can hold to that. But if a kid throws a chair now, we could still say work still has to be done before TV, but if they throw a chair, we don't say now you lost TV for tomorrow too. And then they curse at you, and then you say, well, now you've lost, you know, your all electronics and you're grounded and you can't go outside for the week. Because if we keep ratcheting out the punishments for some kids, they're going to ratchet up their punishment, their misbehavior, and we're just locked in a power struggle. We want to avoid that. Okay? That's not useful. All of that helps to build a good relationship. Now, we're moving into crisis mode. Step two, behavior management. The kid is revving up emotionally. You can start to see them getting into that meltdown mode. before they're quite there, there's certain things we can do to try to avoid a full-on meltdown. There's certain nonverbal skills we can do to increase some safety. If you've got a crocodile at hand, maybe I don't go face-to-face, chest-to-chest with that crocodile and start yelling and confronting them. I get quieter. I don't look them right in the eye. I give them some space. Because remember, when certain people are threatened, that's what produces that meltdown. Fear leads to anger, rage sometimes. So if a kid is most threatened and ready to act out, that may not be a time when I'm going to start reading them the Riot Act. Certain kids, I'm going to give them some space. Listen, I'm over here. When you're ready, I'll come back. Listen, agree, and apologize when necessary. Certain words we can use that bring down that emotional, you know, upset for certain kids. What does it mean to listen? It means at the moment when a kid is very upset, they feel something wasn't fair. Sometimes it helps to listen to them. And that takes a ton of tolerance. Kids know who's going to get them in trouble and who's really listening to their side. Tell me more. What's going on? Okay, you feel it's unfair because you weren't first, or you lost the game, or you feel it wasn't fair because I didn't give you this thing that you wanted. All right, tell me about that. Fine. So you hear them out. Agree with the kernel of truth. That doesn't mean you have to agree with it. Like they say, well, you're a bad parent because you didn't buy me that video game. You don't have to agree you're a bad parent because you didn't buy them a video game. You can say, I agree that it's so frustrating that you don't get those things that you want. I can see how upsetting that is. Apologize with the part that, apologize but don't take blame. Apologize with, you know, for their upset. I'm so sorry it's so upsetting to you. That doesn't mean you have to, you know, take blame for it. I'm sorry I'm the one who upset you. No, I'm sorry that it's so difficult. Right? So agreeing, apologizing are words that can be calming. Collaborate. It's the most important thing we can do. What does it mean to collaborate? It means helping them find a different way to get what they want. So you have a verbal kid. You can ask them this question. Wait, what is it you want? He says, I'm going to kill my sister. Well, you don't have to agree with that part. But wait, I don't think you really wanted to kill your sister. I think you were mad because you wanted to be first. And she cut you in line, or she took that last piece of cake, or what is it you really wanted? You wanted the cake, right? So what's a better way to get that? You know, let's talk about that. What's the better way to get that? You know, I can make sure you can get that tomorrow if you go about it the right way. We're going to help them find a better way. If you have a nonverbal kid, they're kicking, they're screaming, they're hitting, they're scratching, you know, hold on, I want, and we can show them pictures of perhaps what they want, visual symbols. So instead of having kick, yell, they can have a visual symbol for I need help, or a symbol for back away, I want space, or I need a break. So we can give them some visual symbols so that they can communicate better for what they want. So we're helping them find a better way. That's the most important thing we can do as that behavior is starting to ratchet up. But if it's beyond, they're now in meltdown mode. There's no talking to the kid anymore. Sometimes when logic is gone, we can't keep trying to help them find a better way. We just have to distract them and soothe them. When your kid is in that meltdown mode, there's no more talking to them, we have to say, aha, I see, they're a crocodile now, so what am I going to do? Let me find a way to distract them. Now, how do we distract youngsters? Novel items can be a very helpful way. I keep coins from different countries on me, and I keep Yu-Gi-Oh cards, Pokemon cards, Japanese anime playing cards. These are often special interests or preferred interests of my kids. I keep them on my body because I know at a moment when a kid is melting down, I might take out that coin from Canada or something and say, hey, look, this is a $2 coin. Is that gold? How much is this? Come here. And that kid begins to calm because they've never seen that before. It starts to get their mind off of it. Or a special interest. I was coaching my kids in soccer, and there was a kid in the midst of a terrible fight with another kid. Nobody could calm the kid down, and I happened to have Yu-Gi-Oh cards on me. And we peeled the kid off another kid. He's screaming and yelling, and I say, hey, do you have this Yu-Gi-Oh card? Is this a rare card? And he began to calm down, just got his mind off of it. Certain sensory activities can be calming, too. Some kids like deep pressure. Some kids don't like to be touched. Some kids like to listen to music, to take a walk, to squeeze a squishy ball. There's a variety of things that might be helpful. We need to know what those things are. Okay? And we like to create relaxation folders for our kids of the things that are calming to them. Now, here's what I'm saying. At the moment of your kid's horrible behavior, that's when you might say, hey, come here, I want to show you something. Let's play a game. Let's get our mind off this. Some of you might be worried that that would reinforce a tantrum. Others are going to say, no, it's fine. It's how you soothe kids. Well, I'm going to tell you, sometimes it's soothing. Sometimes it can reinforce a tantrum. Here's the difference. When a kid is trying to escape a task, they don't want to do classwork or homework or clean up the mess they made. If we continually use distraction, come on, let's play a game instead. Let's get our mind off this. Well, then it might reinforce a tantrum. They might have learned that they got out of a task. They were able to escape a demand by yelling and screaming. So then distraction is not going to be a good thing to do repetitively. I'll just do it once, the first time. But then I have to have a plan the next time so they don't keep trying to, you know, yell and scream to get out of the task. Instead, I have to work at helping them to clean up, helping them to do their work, to simplify it so that they don't escape it, right? But if a child or a student or an individual didn't get what they wanted, you go to a grocery store and they want a piece of candy and you say no and they throw a tantrum. Well, if we tickle them and play a little game with them outside and take them out into the parking lot, that's okay to soothe your kid. You don't have to punish them. We don't always have to punish kids. We have to sometimes calm and soothe our kids. So then it's okay. If they yell and scream and we give in and give them the candy, that's not good, because then they learn bad behavior leads to getting what they want. But if instead they're yelling and screaming, they don't get the candy, but we get their mind off of it by showing them a Yu-Gi-Oh card, by tickling them, by playing a game, that's okay. We're not giving into the candy, but we're getting their mind off of it. Okay? So let's say you have a repeat problem, though, now, right? Can't just keep distracting and putting out that fire. What are we going to do with repeat problems? So kids continually doesn't want to clean up, continually doesn't want to do homework, continually has issues when they don't get what they want. For repeat problems, we can't just keep reacting to them. We can't just keep reacting to them. We have to figure out what is triggering those problems. How do we do that? For years, behaviorists have a term for figuring out why a repeat problem occurs. It's called a functional behavioral assessment. What it means is, it's a big fancy word for how come this keeps happening. And what behaviorists want to do is figure out, what the behavior is and when and where it happens. In the 1970s, we didn't worry about why a behavior was occurring. We just looked up what to do about it. If a kid was biting, we'd look up in a book, what do you do about biting? Well, maybe there was an article that said timeout was effective for biting, so you start drawing a timeout procedure. You know, by the 1980s and 90s, we stopped asking, just trying to figure out what to do about that behavior. We found that it was important to ask the question why the kid is biting. Under what circumstances does it occur? Are they biting because they have dental pain? Are they biting every time you give them a writing task because they don't want to write? Or are they biting with a big smile to try to get you to chase them so they can play with you? It matters, because how you intervene depends on why it is they're biting. We'd intervene differently for a kid who doesn't want to do their work than the kid who wants to play with you. So we need to ask, what the circumstances are. Behaviorists call this the ABCs of behavior, antecedent behavior consequence. English translation, before, during, and after. If you tell me what the behavior is, I want to know what happened before the behavior, what happened afterwards, what triggered it. Antecedent means what triggered it. Behavior, what did they do? Consequence, what happened afterwards. If every time a kid throws a tantrum, you give in and give them what they want, well, that may not be good. That may be reinforcing the tantrum. If they have the tantrum every time they didn't get what they want, then I know the kid needs help with waiting and accepting no, that's the trigger, so that's what we're going to work on. I need to know what those triggers are. Usually they're multiple triggers. Well, for years we had our parents and our teachers filling out diaries when they had a repeat problem. you guys as parents and teachers are too busy to do that for all kids all the time. But when you had a repeat problem, we'd say, spend the time keeping track of it. Tell us the before, during, and after to see if we can figure out what's setting that kid off. So we had you filling out diaries. Well, now it's 2011, and everybody has a mobile phone. So now we have these diaries on an app. My No More Meltdown book and all the prevention plans on that book are now on an app. And you can get that at the Apple Store by clicking on No More Meltdowns at the App Store. Or you can go, if you have a Droid, non-Apple product, you can go to simtrend.com/NMM, stands for No More Meltdowns, simtrend.com, simtrend.com. Anyway, what this mobile app does is it allows you to save data about your kid as it's happening. So you have a, you know, outburst. The kid bites somebody, hits somebody. So you bring up on this mobile phone a way to save data about your kid, and you indicate what the behavior was, and it asks you questions about the potential triggers, what might have been happening before that behavior, as well as what happened after the behavior. The mobile device saves the data. I think it's $10.99 to buy the app, but that gives you a year's worth of access to our website, the SimTrend website, that will analyze the data for you. So it'll tell you over a period of time, for this particular challenge behavior, these are the typical triggers, and so these are the prevention plans you can look for. In other words, if you know what the triggers are, these are the prevention plans for those kinds of triggers. So essentially, it does a functional behavioral assessment. What it means is it analyzes what the triggers to your kid's meltdowns are and tells you then what kind of prevention plans you should look for. So let's talk about some typical triggers, because it's much easier to figure out what's triggering your kid's behavior if I give you a list of triggers to think about. These seven triggers, typical triggers, are not the only triggers to kids' meltdowns, but very common categories in my experience for meltdowns. So let's go through some of these typical triggers. Number one, what we call biological issues, hunger, tiredness, and illness. Why would I think a kid is ill or sick? Well, if I see an increase in aggressive behavior or challenging behavior that cuts across many settings, school and home, then I realize, well, maybe this kid's bringing the problem with them wherever they go. In other words, if you have a sudden increase in challenging behaviors across many settings, you start to think, maybe my kid is not feeling well. Let's just check ears, eyes, nose, throat, make sure he doesn't have GERD, gastroesophageal reflux, other common illnesses. Okay? Could be a psychological issue, too. Like, maybe mom is having a new baby, and for the next, you know, 3 weeks or month, this kid is upset everywhere they go because they're getting less attention at home. Sometimes we see that, or a divorce, or grief, or loss. Those things kids carry with them to, you know, across multiple settings. Could be a sensory issue. What do we mean by that? Some kids avoid overwhelming sensory input, so maybe a kid has some noise sensitivity. Like my kid who is in school, who's supposed to walk in the hallway, stay online, and not run. But as soon as they hit the staircase, he runs away clutching his ears because it's really loud in the staircase. It reverberates. So this kid has a sensory issue. Instead of punishing him for running away from the class, we learn that maybe what we need to do is let everybody else go down the staircase first, and then we'll go down with him when it's quieter. Some kids have a different sensory issue. They need tons of stimulation. So when they're in a boring situation or there's too much wait time, you know, or you're on the telephone, they have nothing to do, that's when they're going to have some issues because there's, you know, they need some more stimulation. That brings us to lack of structure, another thing to look for. Lack of structure means that it isn't clear what the rules are, what they're supposed to do. So a real good example of that is, you know, you go to a supermarket with your kids. They're just supposed to maybe sit in the cart. There's not enough for them to do. It's not clear what their job is. And so they begin to pull everything off the shelves and run around like crazy. Sometimes we need to structure those settings, visual supports, a story of what to do when you're in the supermarket, a social story, a picture book, set of skills, a job to do, some groceries to get. We need to add structure. For kids on the spectrum, it usually means visual supports. Are there enough visual supports telling that youngster what's expected of them? especially for nonverbal kids or kids with ADD who may not be hearing what you're saying, they need some visual supports to carve out, you know, what the schedule is, what they're supposed to do. Why do kids have trouble with transition all the time, switching classes, switching activities? Often it's because they don't know what's coming next. And so if we have a visual schedule, it reduces their anxiety of what's coming next. They know what to expect. They know how long it's going to happen for. Okay. The next four categories, I'm going to show you prevention plans for each. So the next category is challenging work, you know, or a demanding situation. That can mean homework, classwork, or it can mean, you know, getting ready for the for school in the morning, putting on your clothes, putting on your shoes, cleaning up, any demanding task. Okay, so I'm going to show you prevention plans for what to do when the behavior or the trigger for their kid's meltdown is a demanding task. The next issue, you're keeping track on the app or on your diary of when the challenging behavior occurs, and it occurs when they had to wait for something or they couldn't get what they want, what we might call denied access to something, some kind of disappointment. So it's when you said, no, they can't have that, you know, piece of cake, or no, they can't watch TV, or no, they can't buy that video game. That's when they're going to have an issue, or they have to wait for something. So we're going to show you prevention plans for that. The next one, you're keeping track of when the problem occurs, and it's what we call a threat to self-esteem. What we mean by that is some of our kids are perfectionists, and they can't tolerate making a mistake or losing a game. So I'm going to show you prevention plans for what to do when kids have trouble with those issues. Okay. Lastly, unmet wishes for attention. What do we do when kids can't tolerate being ignored for a moment or didn't get your full-on attention? And keeping track of when the problem occurs, and it occurs when you're on the phone because you can't attend to them, or when you're helping their sister, and that's when the brother acts out, or you're helping brother, and that's when sister acts out. So we're going to look at those. So let's take a look about how do we create a good prevention plan. If we know what the triggers are, we're going to try to change those triggers, number one. We're going to try to teach the kid a better way to handle the trigger. And number three, we're going to reward the new way to deal with that trigger. And number four, maybe use a loss system when a kid is not already frustrated. Can't use a loss system when kids are on fire and frustrated. I'm not an advocate of punishment by any means. It only inhibits behavior, doesn't teach kids anything necessarily. And it can often add to their frustration if they're already angry and on fire. So we're really going to limit any kind of aversive or punishment in any way. So let's talk about what to do for demands for work. So a kid has a demanding homework task at home. He won't do his work. What do we do? How do we change the trigger? Well, a lot of times our kids have special needs and their homework is challenging. And we give them the work to do and they can't do it. So then we try to help them. Well, let me show you how to do it. And they're so upset at this point, they run away, they scream, they yell, they hit themselves, they run under the table, they won't do it, it's an escalating power struggle, we're chasing them. Well, one of the issues is we've got to do what we call the 80-20 rule, as I spoke about before. Show them how to do it first. You can't give them work. The mistake we make with certain kids is we give them work to do and we say, if you have trouble with it, ask me for help. Certain kids, as soon as they make a mistake, or they need help, it's too late because they're already too upset that they couldn't do it and we've lost them. Certain kids, we can't risk them making any mistakes, so we have to purposely give them work that's easier first, well and under in their control, what we call the 80-20 rule, 80% of what they can do. And then once they have some confidence, we can give them work that's a little challenging that they might make a mistake with, the 20% that's difficult. So we're going to show them what to do first. For verbal kids, explain the learning curve. What do I mean by that? Tell them they're not supposed to be able to do it yet. Kids are not only frustrated that they can't do their work, they're ashamed that they can't do it. And if they feel like not being able to do it is so shameful, they can't ask for help. It's embarrassing. It's shameful. Unless we say to them, you're not supposed to be able to do this work. Your teacher told me I have to show you how to do it first. We're going to do it together. Then it's not shameful if they need help because you've set their expectation that they're not supposed to be able to do it first. Give choice. If a kid can't do their work, it's really challenging. Not only do we simplify that work, but we give them a choice. Which one do you want to do? We show them how to do it first, you know, and which one do you want to do? It's always, if you don't want to do something, better to have some choice with it. Visual supports. Make concrete what otherwise is too abstract. If you're doing math, draw a picture. You know, doing place value, what's in the tenths place, hundredths place, thousandths place, next to a decimal. Have lines showing you this is the tenths, this is the hundredths, this is the thousandths. Without visual supports, it's very challenging. If you have kids with ADHD and attention issues, reduce the length of time for a particular task. So if you saw a worksheet with 9 problems on it, certain kids with ADD will never sit down to do their work. They'll say, I broke a pencil. I broke another pencil. I need a drink of water. I'm thirsty. My knee hurts. I have to stop for a second. They'll never come to the table. But if instead you show them just one problem, we're just going to do one problem. You do one problem on a page, and then we say, okay, let's take a quick sensory break. Let's do some jumping jacks. Let's do some push-ups. Now let's come back. We're just going to do one more problem. It's going to take you twice as long to do a problem and then a little exercise, then a problem, then an exercise, but you'll get more done than if they saw 9 problems on the same page, because that's too intimidating. Okay? So we have to shorten, reduce the length of what they're seeing. Kids don't want to clean up. We're going to help clean up with them. I'm going to show you how to do make a game of it. All right? We'll see if we can throw it in these bins. Make some visual bins, visual supports for cleanup. Okay. What's the skill we're going to use when kids don't want to do a difficult task? Instead of refusing, noncompliance, defiance, refusing to do it, the skill we're going to teach is trying when it's hard. Kid doesn't want to do his work, and we're not going to say, we're not going to reward the kid necessarily for doing the work perfectly. Instead, we're going to reward a new skill called trying when it's hard. We're going to say to certain kids, if it's difficult, well, just watch me do it first. If you have kids who refuse to do something, extremely defiant and oppositional, you can say to them, well, don't do it. Don't do it yet. Just watch me first. Because half of those kids who are refusing to do something aren't just willfully refusing. They're intimidated. They're fearing that they're going to mess up and they don't know how to do it and they're going to make a mistake and be embarrassed and humiliated. So we say to them, don't do it. Don't do it. Just watch. Now that they watched, we say, well, don't do all of it, but just do this first part with me. Just do a little part. It's what we call gradual exposure to what they're fearful of. They don't want to clean up. They don't want to do their homework. Oh, well, just watch first. Okay, now just do a little bit with me. So we say, try a little, ask to watch, ask for help, take a break, take a 2-minute break, now come back, try it again. We always time our breaks. You can't have a break that goes on all day. It's on a timer. 2 minutes, you take a break, come back, try it again. Or negotiate. Say, well, I'll do this part, you do this part. You know, we'll negotiate how much each of us does. Not all kids should negotiate. Some negotiate too much. But certain kids who are very black and white, who absolutely refuse to do things, might benefit from negotiating a little bit. So this is some of what we're going to do. And then we'll create a reward program for kids who are really chronically frustrated. This is not for kids who are in our gifted and talented programs who are doing work with ease and having a fun time with it. This is for kids who are chronically frustrated around work. We're going to put them on a reward program for trying when it's hard. You're not going to get rewarded for doing your work right or wrong. You'll get rewarded for trying or asking for help or asking to watch first. So every time you try or ask for help, you're going to get a point. When you get enough points, you're going to have some kind of reward. We're rewarding effort over outcome. So that's what we mean by a trying when it's hard poster. Right? And no law systems here. If we say work has to happen before computer time, we'll hold to it. But if the kid throws chairs and curses at you, don't end up adding punishments on top of that, because then you're just getting into an escalation. What do we do for waiting, accepting no, right? What do we do around that? So you have a nonverbal kid, as I did, who couldn't wait when he came to a classroom. My job was to help him play with other kids. And he saw a bunch of cookies lined up for a Valentine's Day party, and he couldn't wait for them. And he starts yelling, cookie, cookie. So he's got limited language, but he could articulate cookie because he wants it. Teacher says he can't have the cookie because it's for a party that's not for an hour from now. So she says, you got to tell him he can't have the cookie. So he's a little language. I'm trying to tell him. I take out a dry erase board. I say, first play, then cookie. Cookie when the big hand gets to the one. I'm trying to explain to him. He can't have the cookie yet when the big hand gets to the one. He doesn't understand it. He's just screaming and yelling. He wants the cookie. Teacher says, you got to take him out of here. It's too disruptive. So I physically have to take him out of the class. He's yelling and screaming because he couldn't have the cookie. We're in meltdown mode, crocodile mode. Now I got to distract him. I look for something, Yu-Gi-Oh cards, Pokemon cards, something to get his mind off of it. I calm him down for a moment. But now I got to figure out how to teach him how to wait. How do you teach a nonverbal youngster with autism how to wait? Because from his perspective, when I said no, he can't have the cookie, it just meant no, he can't ever have it the rest of his life. It's the end of the world. How do I teach it? I take out cookies that I have in my classroom. I say, want a cookie? I say, wait. I put on a timer, 10 seconds, beep, now you can have the cookie. Then I say, you want two cookies? So I show him two cookies. Cookies, he says, you got to wait. I put out a timer, visual timer, so he can see it. Wait 30 seconds, beep, now you can have two cookies. Then I said, you want three cookies? I say, wait, put out a timer, wait 45 seconds, now you can have three cookies. He begins to learn that wait doesn't really mean no. That wait means there's a timer, and when the timer goes off, the longer the wait, the bigger the reward. And that's a good way to help kids learn to wait, that we begin to use timers so that they learn that wait doesn't mean never. Visual timers are good. They can see how soon it is they're going to get what they want. All of us are easier able to wait when we know when it is we're going to get what we want. If you have kids 24 hours, 7 days a week who want their video games, put it on a schedule. It's going to be easier to turn off the TV and come to dinner, or turn off the video game, come to dinner, if two things happen. Number one, they know when they're going to be able to go back to that video game, so put it on a visual schedule. And number two, you don't interrupt the game in the middle. That's tough. You're going to have to find ways to pause those games so they don't lose their data. So that's a technical issue that you can go to certain sites and find out how to pause these video games without losing data. Okay. What else? Accepting no. That's more difficult. What if my kid wants Black Ops, as my son did? He said, Dad, I want Black Ops. I say, it's rated mature. You're 10 years old, you're 11 years old, you can't have it. And the meltdown, right? What do we do? We want to teach our kids that if they don't get what they want and they're cool about it, I'll be so happy I'll give them something else they want. That there's always something to live for. That's the concept. Always something to live for. So I have to teach him that if he stays cool, there's always something to live for. And so the way we do this is with things that he doesn't care so much about, we practice accepting no. After he's eaten, he doesn't really want food, but I get him to ask me for some snack, and I say, nope, you can't have that. And I say, okay. And I say, great, accepting no. You just got a point on your accepting no chart. So we're going to create a little disappointment poster or an accepting no poster. And every time he accepts no, I'm going to give him a point. When he gets enough points, he can get a reward. And we're going to start with easy things, like accepting no around food when you're not really hungry, or asking to do an activity I know he doesn't really want. We're going to start with easy things. He builds up some points, and then we're going to get to the harder things, like when he wants to go to get Black Ops. The only way this is going to work, skills like this don't generalize. You got to prime their forebrain ahead of time. If you're going past GameStop, where this kid is going to ask you to go and stop and get Black Ops, you got to say, we're passing GameStop. In a moment, we're going to be driving in the car, and I'm just getting you ready because we won't be able to go there, and I'm not buying you Black Ops, but if you're cool, when you get home, I'm still going to let you have dessert with dinner, and you're going to get your video games tonight at home. So we're priming the forebrain why it's still worth living if you don't get Black Ops. You've got to prime kids' forebrains every day about the potential disappointments, what they won't get, but why it's still worth living, because there's other good things that they're going to get. Get that in the forebrain ahead of time, because if you forget and you pass GameStop and they ask, can we go, and you say no, they're going to be in crocodile mode, and you got to pull off on the side of the road and start trying to distract them, and that can be dangerous. So better to prime them ahead of time. Self-esteem. What do we do about kids who can't tolerate mistakes and losing? Well, we're going to teach them that mistakes are good. That's how you learn. And we're going to reward them for that. We're going to say, if you can, you know, I know if you're making a mistake, you're trying new things. So you're learning new things. If you get everything right, it means you might not have learned anything new. So I know if you make mistakes, you're learning more. You're growing. And that's what I want you to do. So I'm going to take my perfectionists and I'm going to put them on a behavior chart. And I'm going to say, if you make a mistake and you don't get mad, you learn from it. You ask for help and you learn from it. I'm going to give you 3 points on your behavior chart. But if you get the work done right the first time, that's only worth 2 points. Okay? If you get mad, that's 1 point. You got to try harder. So you're going to get more points for actually making a mistake and handling it than doing the work done right the first time. We'll do the same for those who are poor sports, who can't tolerate losing. We're going to say if you lose the game and you handle it, you stay calm, you win the invisible game, the game of friendship or the game of self-control. That's more important. That helps you get jobs and have friends. If you can do that, I'm going to give you 3 points. If you win the game, oh, you only get 2 points. If you get mad, that's 1 point. You've got to try harder. What are we doing? We're giving you more points for losing a game and handling yourself than winning the game. That's what we're going to do for those kids. We also have to do the 80-20 rule. Let them win a couple of games first before you practice losing and handling it. Okay? Get them in a good mood first and then say, great, are you ready to lose some? Because if you lose, you don't get mad. That's worth 3 points. Those are some of the things we're going to do. Teasing is another threat to self-esteem, and we try to teach our kids not to worry about what other people think, right? To know that you're okay, to not let other people control your feelings. So we teach them, to check it out first. Hey, are you really teasing me? You really meant that? Because we don't know if people are playing or not. Tell them to stop calmly, ignore, walk away, and if they continue to do it, to report it. Because we want our kids to learn that they need to report that if it continues. And the laws are getting clearer and clearer about bullying. School personnel all over are going to have to report these things. And reporting is different from tattling. Tattling is when you report something that's not harmful. But teasing causes emotional or physical harm, and so it's okay to report it. There's a harm or danger. But if someone's chewing gum in school, well, we don't report that because it's not dangerous. That's tattling. So we have to show that difference. All right, we talked about the reward system for handling mistakes or losing, right? Now what do we talk about? Unmet needs for attention. That's another trigger. I had a 17-year-old with very little language who was stimming with jewelry chains. And every so often he would whip his aide in the back with a jewelry chain. Very dangerous. Well, when we tracked the behavior, the triggers, it was when the aide left his side to go help another student. In other words, he wanted her attention. He was ignored, so we had to teach him better ways to get her attention. And so we taught him to hand her a card that says, I need help, rather than to whip her in the back with a jewelry chain. Okay, a better way to communicate for attention. We also worked on helping him deal with working independently. That was how we modified the trigger. He couldn't be alone. So for 3 months, we worked on him following a visual schedule so he could follow a visual activity schedule, do some puzzles, other worksheets and things on his own so that the aide could actually leave his side. Okay? When you're on the telephone, your kids are going to act out unless you give them something to do and put a timer on and say, this is when I'm going to be with you and this is when I'll be off the phone and this is what I want you to do while I'm doing that. That's a way to modify that trigger so they don't feel, that it's forever, that they're waiting for you. Okay? We need to give certain kids other better ways to get attention, kids who say remarkably inappropriate things to get attention. Those are kids who might be dysregulated, not in an angry way, but in a silly, acting out way. I had a kid who'd go around high school saying to other kids, hey, are you a virgin? How about you? Are you a virgin? Ever tell you about Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky? He'd go to the airport and he'd say, I got a bomb. He got attention in really negative ways. And some kids would laugh, and that would make him do it forever and ever. One of the things we do, and if you have worries about kids in your home who are laughing and reinforcing other kids' inappropriate ways of getting attention, put them on a marble jar system where you say to the kids, if somebody's getting attention in negative ways and you avoid it and you ignore it, we're going to put a marble in this jar. As a group, when we get 20 marbles, we're going to have a party. Right? So we're going to incentivize kids to ignore other people's, a silly behavior. But the other thing we can do sometimes, the only time I might use a punitive system is when a kid is dysregulated, not in an angry way, but a silly, pleasure-seeking way. This kid who would say inappropriate things like, I have a bomb, we put him on something called response cost. It's the least punitive of punishing systems. It's basically saying, I'm going to give you a reward. What do we give this kid? We say, well, you can have a snack and you can watch The Simpsons. He loved watching The Simpsons. You can watch your episode of The Simpsons and you can have a snack. But if you say one of these inappropriate things, so we gave him a list of things he can't talk about, sex, violence, race, religion, and politics. Are you a virgin in the sex category? I got a bonds in the violence category. If you say any of the inappropriate things, you're going to get a warning. Then you'll get another warning. If you say it again, then you're going to lose your Coca-Cola, your snack that you wanted. And then you'll start losing increments of The Simpsons. This is called response cost. There's a cost for responding in an inappropriate way. It was a way of inhibiting this. I wouldn't do this with every kid. Not every kid can tolerate a law system. But they're more likely to be able to tolerate it if they're not an angry, out-of-control kid at that moment, but they're dysregulated in a silly, pleasure-seeking way, as this kid was. So we rewarded him for talking about okay topics, but if he said anything like, I got a bomb, or, you know, talked about sex or things like that, he would begin to lose items on his rewards. That's called response cost. Sensory issues. For kids with sensory issues, we have to change that sensory environment. If there's too much noise, or there's not enough stimulation, we can't sit and have kids wait endlessly with nothing to do. We might have to give them a to-do box, things to do, so they're not so bored. But more importantly, if you have sensory issues, I want our kids to become self-advocates, to be able to say to a teacher or a parent, I have sensory issues, it's too loud for me here, can I go to a quieter area? Or can I go down the stairs when everybody else is already gone? If they don't have the language, maybe we're going to give them a cue card so that they can hand it to a substitute teacher and say, I got sensory issues, it's too loud for me, my other teacher lets me walk in the hallway after everybody's gone. Right? They need to become self-advocates. There are other speakers who are going to talk a lot about sensory issues. So I'm not going to talk about all the sensory issues, but the skill involved for me is learning to be an advocate for yourself, to learn what is not a good sensory environment for you, and to ask for the modifications that we've learned will help. Let's talk briefly about what to do with the unexpected triggers. This is the last thing I want to talk to you about. So far, I've been talking to you about how to prepare your student, your child, your client for the triggers that you know about, demanding work, making mistakes. But what do you do about the unexpected triggers? We want to prepare their forebrain for what to do when the unexpected happens, how to calm down. So we create a relaxation folder with pictures of all the things that calm them down. And it could be pictures of them getting a drink of water, reading a magazine, doing a puzzle, listening to music. And then there's pictures of their safety person in this folder. Safety people, three safety people. Who are safety people? These are the people that they trust to actually help them solve the problem. Verbal or nonverbal, every kid has certain people they trust aren't just going to get them in trouble, but are actually going to help them figure out how to negotiate what they need, how to help them get what they need, how to resolve the issue. And so I say three people because in a school, two will inevitably be out sick or something, at a conference. And so we always want to have three people. And so in the morning, we're going to go over their relaxation folder. If it's a verbal kid, we'll explain, if you get upset, here are the things that calm you down that you can do. And then here are the people you go to. When kids come off the bus, already upset, not ready to do work, go to the relaxation folder, start them right in. Let's get ourselves regulated. Let's get calm. Who do we talk to? And then we'll get to work after that. Right? We got to manipulate the mood first. If it's a nonverbal kid, we can go through a picture sequence. You know, we have a picture of them upset. If upset, here's how we calm. Here's the person we go to help us. If you're a verbal kid, I want you to learn this very important self-talk skill. All problems can be solved if you can wait and talk to the right person. They need to know who do they trust. They need to know that most everything can have some kind of resolution if you can find the right person and you're willing to wait. So every morning I say to my verbal kid who has meltdowns, I say, listen, do you trust me? Something's going to happen today that's good, but something not so good will happen too. I don't know what it is. Maybe you won't have your homework you're supposed to have, or you can't open your locker, or you lost something. But do you trust me? Because if you do, I promise to resolve it. Can you wait until you can talk to me? And so we're going to try to prepare that forebrain for the unexpected disappointments, unexpected problems, and have them repeat that mantra, all problems can be solved if I can wait and talk to the right person. That's what we're going to go over every morning. Now, let's talk a little bit about, briefly, what's out there, and then I want to take some questions. Everything I just went over is in my No More Meltdown book. All the prevention plans for the different triggers, how to handle crises in the moment to distract and soothe kids, how to handle your own feelings. As I mentioned earlier, that Meltdown book is also on an application through Apple. You can go to the App Store, click on No More Meltdowns, or go to simtrend.com on the internet, /NMM, No More Meltdowns, and you can download the mobile version from the internet. On the bottom that you see on the screen there, for those of you with the PowerPoint slides, are all our social skill training books. Manual for elementary school, plus a social skill picture book where we show in picture version, right way and wrong way for certain skills, kids who would benefit from seeing those skills visually. We have also for middle and high school and beyond, a book called Preparing for Life, a manual of social skills training, as well as a social skill picture book for high school and beyond. Pictures right and wrong way for how to engage in certain skills. In the upper left corner is a DVD of a full-day workshop that you can purchase if you needed to do an in-service or if parents wanted to see sort of a full-day workshop that we're doing. And in the upper right is a music CD based on our social skill picture book for young kids. We put a music CD together, putting many of these social skills lessons to song for certain kids who seem to very much tune in to music. And so it's a good way to learn the skills. Parents are putting it on in the car rides. Kids are learning the skills. It doesn't, like anything else, magically help kids generalize skills, but it helps them learn the skills. And so then when you're in the supermarket, you can say number three voice. They know what you're talking about because they heard it in the music, or eye contact, or make sure you share, or take turns, or compromise, etc. That's all I wanted to talk to you guys about. Everything starts with how we feel, right? So if you can control your feelings long enough not to lose your temper or not to give in, but to thoughtfully consider, how do I teach my kid a better way of handling themselves, a better way of dealing with this trigger? That's the goal, okay? So now, what questions do you all have? Nancy, maybe you can help us with that.
Absolutely. Anyone who is on the phone right now and wants to ask a question, please press *2, and that will alert me that you have a question for Dr. Baker. While we're waiting for everyone to raise their hand, I have three questions. I've been furiously writing. How do you teach social skills to a homeschooler? Do you think it's better to integrate them with typical peers, special needs peers, or mixed peers?
All of the above. You know, and everyone's different, okay, but here's the thing. If you have a kid who's homeschooled, you don't necessarily have the same resources you do in school where you have this option to teach a kid. There's two things when we're talking about teaching social skills. You have to answer the question, how am I going to teach them? That is, what strategy to use, and where am I going to teach them? Where refers to individually, in a group, or in a classroom. Some data suggests if you teach skills to everybody in the classroom, you get better generalization because they're learning skills where they need it. Well, if you're homeschooled, you may not have a classroom full of kids. You may not even have a group. You may have to teach them individually. Our social skill manuals were designed to teach skills anywhere. You can teach your youngster skills individually at home. But if you're going to generalize those skills, that's an important piece, you're going to have to find a way to coach that youngster in more natural social situations with kids. That can be with kids who have similar issues. It could be with kids typically developing peers. So the initial teaching can happen one-on-one at home. between parent and child. But then you're going to create a cue card that you're going to cue your kid before you go out to some kind of a group social setting to, you know, engage in certain, you know, those, what are the certain key themes that we're working on with your student. Like maybe your kid has a habit of grabbing things instead of asking. So you've taught them the skill individually at home, but now you have a cue card where you go over just before you go out to any, like the Boy Scouts or something, that says, remember, ask instead of grabbing. And you're working with the Boy Scout personnel there to also coach him so that if he begins to reach for something, you say, ask instead of grab, right? So these are some things that we would do. Now, how do you teach those skills? It depends on their language. Mm-hmm. If they have very limited language, you're going to have to use more visual supports and show them what to do. But if they have quite a bit of language, before I show them what to do, I can actually explain it and do some perspective taking with them. If you grab something, people will be upset. If you ask, they're more likely to, you know, give you those things, et cetera, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And again, callers, if you have a question you'd like to ask, just press star 2. Also, I know that fear and anxiety from personal experience can be a biological issue. I know in addition to teaching these skills, we've been using medication. What is your opinion on, I know a lot of parents ask this, what is your opinion on using an anti-anxiety medication along with?
Yeah. Well, listen, medication can be a very important tool, but it should not be your first choice. For me, the first choice is to look at the environment and the things that are stressing my youngster out, both increasing their frustration and anxiety, and see if we can modify those triggers. If I continually give 4 hours or 5 hours of homework every night to a kid in third grade, that's too much. I got to modify that homework. If there's a sensory issue, there's too much noise going on for my kid, I got to modify those triggers. So I'm going to look to modify the environment, teach them skills to cope, so that if there's too much work, they can learn, instead of freaking out, to ask for help, to ask to watch first, to have a reduction in homework if they're allowed. So these are the things we'll do first, okay? In addition, there's plenty of data to show that 30 minutes of vigorous exercise is as effective as stimulant medication to increase attention, learning, and memory, and as effective as an antidepressant in increasing mood and reducing anxiety. But it's really hard to get kids to do 30 minutes of vigorous physical activity just before school to get them in the right mood. So we're going to try all these things first, but look, if you still have a severe amount of frustration and anxiety that's interfering with functioning, you've modified the environment as much as you can, and the environment now is so limited to your child because of their great anxiety, you might want to add medication as a tool now to see if that could be allow them to function in a setting in which you're hoping they can function. Another reason to consider medication, even before you do all those behavioral interventions, is what if you have an emergency? What if the kid is suicidal or are extremely aggressive, at risk of being expelled? Then you may want to do every intervention you can to help them succeed. And that's when you may not have time to do all the good, positive behavioral support interventions and sensory intervention and all that to see if it's going to work. Mm-hmm. But for me, it should not be the first thing you do. And it can be effective. Again, it can be effective. You need to work also with a prescribing physician who's going to actually get feedback, not just from you as a parent, but from the school directly, so we can evaluate whether the medication is both working and or whether there are side effects. Too often it's prescribed, and then we don't talk to the doctor for a month, you know, until a month later, where they're getting a sketchy report from what we know happens at home, but no report from what's happening in school. So we need someone to evaluate both the good and potential side effects.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, and say you have an emergent reader or an experienced reader. Do you still suggest using visual schedules as opposed to a word schedule?
Oh, you mean a picture schedule versus a written word schedule?
Yes.
I think you could. It's whatever the youngster understands and prefers. Look, we have kids who have very good language and reading skills. And we still sometimes use picture schedules if they're used to it. You know, the designers on Apple use all kinds of picture icons with sophisticated adults, you know, who can read, but the picture icon sometimes is quicker and easier. So it's always okay to use the visual supports. The issue is that can work for everybody. The issue is if you are a nonverbal kid, you can't, and who doesn't read, you can't use all the words.
Right. Maybe combine the two?
Sure, why not?
All right. You must have done a really good job with your presentation because no one has a question. If anybody does have a question that's listening right now, you can press star 2. Remember, this is being pre-recorded for replay sometime during the weekend of April 9th and 10th.
Nancy, there was a question from somebody I read who I think there was an older student who had trouble dealing with not being first.
Yes.
Have to be first with everything. And it's very similar to the trigger I talked about where you have to win a game or you have to do your work perfectly. You know, what we might want to do with a kid like that is talk about, if they're verbal, the advantages of not being first, which is that if you're first online and you're going down the hallway and you meet the principal who's mad that it's too noisy, it's the first person in line who's going to get the brunt of that. Sometimes it's better to not be first, to see what's gone before you. So we might want to teach kids that hidden payoff of not being first, but then we're going to provide the external reward too and say, if you can be second or third, we're going to give you more points for that. And we're going to do it in a playful way. Very often kids can get over their inflexibility if you do it in a playful game way. We're going to play the game not being first. So let's just pretend to line up for a second. Let me show you what I'm going to do. I'm going to model it first. So I'm going to be second. Oh, I'm second, but that's okay because then I can, you know, benefit from seeing what comes before me. I won't get in trouble. Maybe the person in front of me might get in trouble. And I get points for being second. Now you try it. And so then we have the kid try it. Okay, let's see if you can be second. Great job. You get points for that. A couple more points, you get a reward. We do it in a playful way like that. Then we get it on a behavior chart to help generalize the skill. And we talk about during the day, if you can be second or third, you're going to get points for that good towards a reward, much like we would do for a kid who had trouble making mistakes or not being first, or losing a game.
Uh-huh. Another good question that came in through the web was from Cindy in Linwood. She asks, what would you suggest for helping a teenager with high-functioning autism to deal with continuous self-negativity?
Well, I don't fully know what that means in terms of what that kid is doing. Let's assume that they're putting themselves down. I'm so stupid, I can't do anything.
Right.
I'm so stupid, I can't do anything could be a result of not being able to tolerate correction or mistakes, in which case, what we talked about earlier, here's the issue again. When you tell me they're continually being negative, I want to know what the trigger is for that. They're not continually being negative. They're doing it at certain times, and it may be a lot of times. We want to know what the trigger is. If the trigger was when they had to do difficult work or when they had to deal with a mistake, then we're going to do the kinds of things I talked about earlier to help them. You know, I want you to make mistakes. That means you're learning. It's a good thing. Or when you have difficult work, instead of saying, I'm stupid, I can't do it, you ask for help. You ask to watch first. You're not supposed to be able to do it first. So we're going to do those kinds of things. Another thing is that when kids are putting themselves down, it's also sometimes serves a function of getting out of punishment. So let's say there's a brother, a little boy, he hits his sister. And now the parents go to reprimand that little boy for hitting the sister. And the kid says, I'm so stupid. I can't do anything right. You just hate me. You should just get rid of me. Well, then the function of that negative behavior is to get out of trouble. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, we may have to ignore some of that and say, we could say, you know, well, no, you're not. We don't hate you, but you can't hit your sister, you know. So we have to look if that kind of behavior is a means to soften the parents' you know, confrontation about something bad that the kid had just done.
Sounds good. If folks have questions after we're off of here because we're almost out of time, is there
actually
a way they can
repeat? Sorry to interrupt everybody. This is Ernest here. I extended it 15 minutes so you can take some questions if Dr. Baker can condense.
Unfortunately, I can't do that, actually, because I'm
okay.
on a schedule. I can do 5 minutes.
Okay, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Thank
Sorry
you.
Sorry to interrupt, guys. Sorry.
You're fine.
No problem. I apologize. I have to actually get to a school and do some consulting today, so I have about 5 minutes. But
you're a very busy man.
No, well, everybody's busy. Parents are busy because we're all busy, but I'm happy to answer anything I can.
Well, tell me, is there a way that they can reach you to ask questions after this is over?
Yeah, if you go to my website, jedbaker.com, my publisher set that up, jedbaker.com. I also have another website of my private practice, which is socialskillstrainingproject.com. People can always email questions. The contact information is there. Sometimes it takes a while for me to get back, but they can do that. And if anybody's in the New Jersey area or in the East Coast, on April 29th, I'll be doing a full-day conference in Livingston, New Jersey, and all of that's up on the website. And be available for questions there. But that's a good full-day workshop on some of what we're talking about, as well as a little bit more on social skills training and setting up those peer buddy programs and peer leadership programs.
That's wonderful. I want to thank you today, Dr. Baker, for taking the time to talk with us. This is just, we can't talk about this enough because it just keeps coming up and coming up, especially for our family. I know it must be for everyone's family. The scenery changes and we have new problems pop up. So it's great to have this information repeated several times.
Hey, my pleasure. And here's my hope. My hope is that what I've talked about today brings hope to parents and teachers. Because as I said in the beginning, it turns out hope is one of the better predictors of your kid improving their behavior. That all of our kids can do better. All of our students progress. It's just going to be a matter of how much support they're going to need in order to do that, to begin to figure out what some of those triggers are, how to modify those, and how to teach them the skills that they need. So, of course, you're going to be worn down sometimes because you're with your kids 24 hours 7. But you got to refuel. If you don't have it now, we got to find a respite. We have to find a way for you to refuel, to go to the gym, to take a day with your spouse, refuel. If it's possible, an hour, a half hour just to refuel, listen to music, take a walk, come back. And with a little bit of renewed energy, think about how do I educate my kid to move forward. All kids improve. They all improve. Okay? Doesn't mean a kid who has no language all of a sudden has language, or a kid who is acting out up the up all over the place all of a sudden is perfectly calm. But everyone can improve. But you got to not give up, and you got to continue to exhaust all possibilities and get the support you need to be able to do that.
It is hard when you're in it up to your neck to remember that they are changing, they are growing, they are learning, and so things do improve. Thanks for reminding us.
My pleasure.
I want to remind our listeners that this webinar will be replayed sometime during our autism conference coming up April 9th and 10th. If you want a transcript of this event, you can also join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking the button on your screen. We will send you a copy of the webinar audio and transcript, plus send you 29 other webinars when you join. Also, please tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. That number again is 877-211-0212. I want to mention that we will be pre-recording another webinar. This will be Tuesday, April 5th, which is tomorrow, at 7 o'clock Pacific, 10 Eastern. The topic will be fitness for the autism population, and it will be with Eric Chesson. So I hope you will join us for that. And I want to thank everybody. I hope you have a wonderful day. Thank you, Dr. Baker.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.